Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We now have all the panelists and discussants. Can you see me? I'm a little short. But I decided to stand here in between the panelists and the audience so that I'll be able to make it more lively. I mean, the discussion, interactive. My name is Imai Yoshi, please call me if you like. I'm a Japanese television presenter, and this is my second time to be at IGF. I have a couple of questions that I may ask myself too. How many of us feel very safe or secure when we are online every day? And how many of us who are operating organizations, running companies, feel secure about your business? I would say no one can say yes. We are not safe at all, but we cannot live a day without the internet. We internet users are entitled to expect security. Here today, we are turning to the distinguished panelists, stakeholders in the panel, to satisfy our rightful demand, or at least show us convincing determination to take a lead in this war against cyber crimes. Now, let me introduce you the chairman of the session, Mr. Antonio Tavares. Mr. Tavares now sits in the board of Brazilian Internet Steering Committee, and he is known as one of the first entrepreneurs in Brazil to start to launch an ISP. And he is also twice member of the ICANN nominating committee. Mr. Tavares, would you give us your opening remarks now?
Thank you, Imai. Good afternoon, everybody. I will address my speech in my Portuguese. Boa tarde a todos. Obrigado pelo convite, pela honra de presidir uma sessão tão importante como esta de segurança, quiçá o tema que mais nos preocupa a todos. Agradeço a presença de todos e quero que este painel seja transformado não apenas no mais importante, mas aquele que, cujos resultados possam transformar-se em uma contribuição mais forte para que a internet seja cada vez mais segura. Mesmo sabendo que segurança é, na vida real e na virtual, uma preocupação constante e universal, nós sabemos que nunca existe segurança total. Através dos tempos, se tem provado que melhorar condições de segurança é como uma corrida entre gato e rato, ou como costumam dizer os policiais, onde o criminoso sempre está um passo à frente do agente de segurança. Na vida virtual, em particular na internet, não poderia ser diferente. O sonho de termos um mundo de pureza jamais passou de um sonho, e hoje nos deparamos com dificuldades cotidianas, novas, por vezes inimagináveis, que temos de enfrentar e vencer com coragem, com criatividade, com tecnologia e, sobretudo, com educação. Frequentemente, diversos segmentos da sociedade, ou mesmo governos, se apresentam com propostas de solução, infelizmente nem sempre adequadas, num mundo onde a ausência de fronteiras, a liberdade e o pluralismo de visões, costumes ou opiniões dificilmente permite hegemonia. Essa é uma das razões pela qual poucos acreditam que se possam resolver problemas de segurança através de legislação, a não ser, evidentemente, naquilo que é novo, que prolifera na rede sem precedentes, como os vírus, malware, etc. ilícitos não existentes antes e por isso que não contém tipificação na legislação existente em qualquer dos países. No Brasil, nós podemos identificar que mais de 95% dos crimes praticados na internet têm legislação capaz de os cobrir da legislação já existente. Refira-se que os códigos penal e de processo penal no Brasil datam de 1940 e 1941. É evidente que existe legislação complementar a cobrir toda a evolução, mas assim mesmo, boa parte de tudo que é previsto já existe. Entendemos a internet como uma forma cooperativa de ação, de construção positiva, de uma nova sociedade. E é com fé numa cooperação intensa que acreditamos poder consolidar uma ferramenta cada vez mais forte de comunicação, de crescimento e de integração. Evidentemente que precisamos de ficar atentos, cada vez mais indivíduos e as corporações, porque as ameaças não cessam. Precisamos de um esforço hercúleo de educação, porque não basta dotar as escolas de computadores e de banda larga. Precisamos de preparar os educadores, no momento onde, por muito que queiramos, o parental control ainda não pode ser eficientemente utilizado, já que a internet, numa forma muito curiosa e por ser nova, inverte a hierarquia e frequentemente crianças e adolescentes sabem muito mais que os próprios pais e aprendem rapidamente como burlar as ferramentas de controle e os filtros providos pelos browsers. Não é por acaso que está em evidência nesse momento nas manchetes internacionais a preocupação internacional, a preocupação do Secretário-Geral das Nações Unidas em relação à evolução das organizações criminosas em relação à pedofilia, em relação a todos esses crimes cibernéticos que começam a montar estratégias de mudança de local, utilizando recursos fantásticos, recursos económicos fantásticos para atingir meios que são de todo lamentáveis. Nós todos precisamos estar atentos a isso e cuidar do futuro das nossas crianças. Esta manhã se falava de direitos humanos, se falava de privacidade, e muito se precisa continuar falando na luta contra essa pornografia infantil e pedofilia com firmeza, com colaboração entre todas as culturas, entre todas as linguagens, entre todos os costumes e sem qualquer restrição. Não podemos ceder nenhum espaço ao crime. Com esperança firme no campo da segurança e em especial de transações, já vemos chegar em soluções técnicas para nos proteger efetivamente, tal como, por exemplo, o DNSSEC. A colaboração entre governos, autoridades judiciais, vai começando a se entender e a se intensificar. E aí reside, junto com a tecnologia, uma parte do caminho e da solução que todos almejamos. Nossa esperança, que a luz que emanará deste painel, através das diferentes visões, das diferentes opiniões e dos diferentes posicionamentos, possa ser uma grande contribuição ao desenvolvimento da internet e que este evento, que o Brasil e o Comitê Gestor da Internet se esforçaram por realizar, possam se transformar num marco histórico e importante na história do mundo. Muito obrigado a todos.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tavares. Now, for the next 2 hours, I would like to give you how we are going to proceed the session. First, we ask each of the 6 panelists to make their points in 4 minutes. And then we turn to 6 of the discussants sitting in the first row of the floor to challenge the panelists with only 2 minutes though. And in between, we invite the questions from the floor, comments from the floor. So the ladies around will give you papers to question, and with the question, will you identify your name and affiliation? We will collect them here, and then I will come back to you when the time comes. And we will try to make this more interactive, lively session. First, let me introduce the panelists on the stage. From your left, I have the list here. Kristin Hopers. And next, Juan Chenkin, Ralph Bendrot, and Tavares, Mr. Tavares, and Mr. Kumar, and Ms. Lamia Chafai, Marco Gelk, and Zahid Jamil. Those are the six panelists today. And I would first like to invite Ralph to make your comments about the security.
Thank you very much. I'm not a techie, so I don't know too much about how to technically secure information networks and the internet. I'm a political scientist, and my background is in security policy analysis. So I will try to give you some ideas of how important it is to make clear what we talk about and in which ways we talk about it. So first of all, what is security in the first place? What is that? It's a very abstract concept. The most basic definition of security is that it's control over the future. And that's by a German sociologist from the 60s in a standard book on security theory. The thing is, the future is always open. You can try to analyze some trends, but you know from the weather forecast that, you know, it's not always 100% clear what happens next day. So we will never get 100% security because of this. And that means the need for security can never be satisfied to 100%. There will always be insecurities and uncertainties about what will happen tomorrow or next year. So because of that, people who are active in the security field, especially security politicians, have a tendency to ask for more and more and more and more security measures, you know, because there's always some uncertainty around the next corner. So what we have to do, I think, in this discourse is to deliberately draw a line somewhere and decide when we have done enough for security and when we should focus on other issues. And of course, one limitation for more and more and more security measures is limitations of resources, like money, personal attention, things like that. Another line for this would be binding norms like human rights or criminal law. So, for example, I cannot do everything I want for my security if it creates problems for the security or the well-being of others, of course. So that's the first thing. Security is never really 100%, and we have to draw a line and think about where it's enough. The second is then still what do we mean with security? And here I want to just give you some examples of how the object to be secured can be really, really different. We have the very famous term national security. The security of the nation, of a society, which is actually pretty vague. To some people in civil society, it's actually a scary term because a lot of things, also human rights infringements and so on, are done under the excuse of national security. But of course, in the context of internet governance and security of networks and how also nations nowadays depend on information networks, there could be one potential global governance, global public policy issue that could be addressed maybe in the future at the IGF or elsewhere, that could be arms control in cyberspace. You know, as more nations are entering the virtual arms race and are setting up cyber attack units in their armies and so on, I think there's a need for arms control. We did a big conference on that in Berlin a few years ago. So that's national security. Then, from a totally different perspective, you can speak about the security of networks, of the technical networks. Here, I and a lot of other people would say it might be better and more helpful to talk about reliability instead of security. Because it makes much clearer what you actually want. You want the networks to be up and running and the data and the packets to flow. And one global governance aspect, and this has been addressed here in a couple of workshops, is more interaction, more cooperation on a global level among the security emergency response teams and so on, computer emergency response teams. But here also, if you look at global public policy or regional public policy, like the Council of Europe Cybercrime Convention, for example, or how it was transposed into German law recently, the opposite of good is not always bad, but can also be well-intended. If you start criminalizing hacking tools that a lot of system administrators need for testing the security of their networks, then you might actually try to do something for security, but the unintended consequence is that you're less secure in the end.
Rolf, will you wrap up?
Okay. You could talk about the security of the endpoints of the computers at the end of the network, or security of companies, of businesses. I want to end with the security of the users, the citizens, and this is probably in the end what it's all about, what also national security should be about. And here we need to talk about protection against fraud, protection against things like cyber crimes and so on, but also about the protection of privacy. And we had a couple of very interesting discussions over the last days on how, with latest technologies, you can actually have better privacy and, at the same time, better security for the users.
Thank you, Rolf.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the second speaker is Wan Chengqin. Please, Mr. Wan.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. 我接下来还是用我的母语来发言。 我的名字叫黄成清，我来自中国，我是中国互联网协会的秘书长。首先，我要感谢IGF给我们提供了一个面对面的交流的机会。伴随着互联网的发展与应用的广泛，
Will you just wait? We are getting two sounds. Yeah.
Okay. 女士们、先生们，大家下午好。 OK， 女士们、先生们，大家下午好。我的名字叫黄成清。
Yeah, still mixing, still mixing.
喂，听到了吗？大家下午好，我的名字叫黄成清，我来自中国，我是中国互联网协会的秘书长。首先， 要感谢IGF给我们大家提供了一个面对面交流的机会。伴随着互联网的发展与应用的广泛，网络安全与反垃圾邮件工作将是一个永恒的主题。魔高一尺，道高一丈，给我们带来了挑战。我们大家必须团结起来，勇敢地面对。然而，国际社会面对垃圾邮件的泛滥 和网络安全事件的日益严重，缺少足够的有效手段。在这方面，私营企业和民间组织
，Yeah， we'll just check the system. We are hearing two voices, two languages.
有什么问题吗？能够我来。
What channel for the English?
One.
Yeah, I have one, but I'm hearing two voices, and you are.
Channel one. Okay.
And transcribers have the same problem. Yeah, will you try once? Will you try?
Okay. Okay. 女士们、先生们，大家下午好。我的名字叫黄澄清，我来自中国，我是中国互联网协会的秘书长。首先，我要感谢 IGF 给我们大家提供了一个面对面交流的机会。
Maybe other microphone is picking up the sound. We cannot understand that.
给我们创造了一个面对面交流的机会。
The next microphone is on. Is that okay? The red ones, Will you cut it off?
Okay. 好，伴随着互联网的发展与应用的广泛，网络安全与反垃圾邮件工作将是一个永恒的主题。魔高一尺，道高一丈，给我们带来了挑战。我们必须团结起来，勇敢地面对。然而，国际社会面对垃圾邮件的泛滥和网络安全事件的日益严重，缺少足够的手段。在这方面，私营企业和民间组织已经做了一些积极的努力，但是任重道远。我的建议是，网络安全和反垃圾邮件工作应当列入各国政府的社会管理和公共服务的工作计划。在对付网络安全的威胁和垃圾邮件，在全球要建立两个层面紧密和广泛的合作机制，一个是政府层面的合作机制，主要是负责立法和司法，建立打击网络犯罪的高效快速司法合作机制，或者叫快速通道，以及规则的制定。一个是民间组织和私营企业层面的合作机制，主要是操作层面的合作，负责网络安全事件、垃圾邮件信息的交换与共享，和网络安全事件的应急处理机制的建立。在这方面，联合国和 ITU 应该发挥更大的作用。互联网发展到今天，那种互联网不需要政府管理的观点是错误的。互联网的治理需要政府的介入，特别是在网络安全与垃圾邮件的治理方面更是如此。拿中国的例子来讲，根据英国网络安全公司 Sophos 公司的统计，中国的垃圾邮件在2006年一季度占了全球垃圾邮件的总数的21%左右，排名全球第二。2006年3月，中国颁布了打击垃圾邮件的法律，随后对垃圾邮件发送者依法进行了处罚，得到了社会的各方广泛赞扬。另一方面，中国互联网协会反垃圾邮件工作委员会也做了卓有成效的工作。他们开展了网民的教育，发放了100万张反垃圾邮件的宣传卡和10000副印有抵制垃圾邮件方法的扑克牌，培训了1000名邮件服务器管理员，由私营企业联合建设了反垃圾邮件综合处理平台，实行了白名单和黑名单机制，另外进行了广泛的国际合作等等。那么今年10月，同样是英国网络安全公司 Sophos 发布的报告看，中国的垃圾邮件占了全球垃圾邮件的4.9%，下降了16个百分点。中国互联网协会自己的统计，2006年3季度，中国的垃圾邮件占全球垃圾邮件的59%，到2007年3季度统计显示，占全部 垃圾邮件占全部邮件的55%，下降了4个百分点。然而，在网络安全事件方面，网络钓鱼、网页篡改、木马攻击、僵尸网络等网络攻击事件大幅度上升，远远高于互联网用户、互联网主机、互联网网站的增长速度。2006年的6月到2006年的7月，中国的网民增长了32%，网站增长了66%，主机增长了23%，国际出入口带宽增长了46%。然而，网络仿冒事件接受的举报增长了142%，被植入木马的主机增长了4193%，网页篡改增长了391%。这些网络安全事件的增长，34%来自中国大陆，66%的增长来自于中国大陆以外的其他国家和地区。我要说的主要原因是，黑客攻击从过去以炫耀自己的技术为目的，转变为现在以盈利为目的，形成了产业链。面对巨大的利益链条，法律严重滞后，特别是国际层面的政府间的司法合作效率极其低下，难以胜任。对于像 CNCERT-CC 这样的组织，虽然做了大量的工作，但是缺少司法的介入和国际的司法合作，很多事情力不从心。我希望这个问题能够引起大家的重视，特别是联合国有关部门应该发挥重要的作用。这就是我的观点，谢谢大家。
Thank you very much, and sorry for the disturbances on the audio. Next, the third speaker, Marco, please. Yeah.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It was pointed out in the beginning that it's questionable if legal standards will help us to fight effectively against cybercrime and secure it. I would nevertheless like to point out the importance of legal standards. We have excellent technical standards. I mean, they were developed for a different purpose, but we can use them very well at the moment. And it's fascinating to see that there are people in this room who will very likely not all share the same political ideas and are not even using the same kind of machines. But we're using the same technology, and it's working. It's the basis of our work. If you don't accept the technology, you cannot communicate in that network. We don't have those standards with regard to laws. We don't have single legal standards at the moment, and that is causing a lot of trouble. The chairman pointed out that in most cases there are sufficient substantive criminal law provisions. And I do agree, in many countries we do have sufficient criminal law provisions, but the difficulty that we're facing is the fact that law enforcement agencies do need to cooperate. And that is something that is lacking at the moment. It does not help you if you have sufficient instruments in place if you cannot cooperate with other law enforcement agencies on a very quick level. Currently, we're still using traditional instruments that take weeks and months, and as you know, those evidence that you might need to trace offenders back might be only available for minutes or hours. So we need to change that, and this is something that we need to address. Currently, we only have one international convention in place that addresses these difficulties, and that's the Convention on Cybercrime from the Council of Europe, which was the topic of a number of workshops. And it was very interesting to see how people were dealing with the convention and how far it helped them. This convention is signed by 43 states, and that's for sure not all in the world. And if you look at the signatures, you will realize that it is signed by countries that are well developed, that have very good technical infrastructure, and that realized how important legal basis and international cooperation is for them to protect their e-commerce businesses. So what was achieved by this convention already is that with having countries like the United States to ratify it, those countries that are providing services in the internet, very important infrastructure services, are on board. And law enforcement agencies from any place in the world who have similar legal standards can actually contact them and cooperate with them in a very quick way. What the convention has not yet succeeded is to address more countries from developing countries, more countries in this area. And since 2005, the number of internet users in developing countries is larger than the number of internet users in highly developed countries. So what the plan for the future must be is to protect those users, to protect the potential victims from cybercrime and improve legislation there. And in this context, I would like to point out the work of the ITU that is addressing the challenges of developing countries all over the world by providing assistance, what they always did, trying to help them with standardization. And they were pointing out the importance of the Convention on Cybercrime as one model law and helped those countries to improve the standardization already. We need to continue this. It cannot be the end. We need to continue this in the future and get more people involved in this discussion. So what I see as the main advantage of that Convention on Cybercrime at the moment is that the convention has a committee where all signature states participate in and can continue to develop further legislation in this matter, participate in this very important process of standardization, legal standardization. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing more progress made in the developing countries. ITU is going to have a workshop in Cape Verde in about 2 weeks for African countries, especially. They had one in Vietnam and they had one in Buenos Aires recently. So I see this on a good way, but there is a long way ahead of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Now I would like to introduce Lamia. Lamia.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Merci, Monsieur le Modérateur. Permettez-moi de parler en français. Donc, je vais parler. Je m'appelle Lamia Chafaï de l'Agence tunisienne d'Internet en Tunisie. Donc, je vais parler de la question de sécurité d'une perspective nationale, donc par rapport à mon pays, la Tunisie, mais aussi d'une perspective régionale, donc par rapport à l'Afrique. Il est clair que aujourd'hui, dans nos pays, nous souhaitons tirer profit des opportunités que nous offre Internet, notamment l'économie numérique, tous les services de e-gouvernement, de e-commerce, etc. Mais tout cela ne peut se faire que si nous instaurions un environnement de sécurité et donc de confiance pour pouvoir développer ces services. Toutefois, aujourd'hui, nous notons que dans notre région, il est important qu'il y ait la sensibilisation et donc toute la formation par rapport à la question de la sécurité. Donc aujourd'hui, je citerai notamment la Tunisie est le seul pays à disposer d'un centre d'alerte donc et de réponse aux incidents, un Computer Emergency Response Team. Donc nous souhaitons voir plus de pays adhérer à ce type de structure. Et donc il est essentiel que nous puissions optimiser aussi nos ressources pour ne pas devenir des victimes, comme ça a été déjà bien mentionné. Aujourd'hui, au risque d'ignorer les risques de sécurité qui existent sur Internet, nous pouvons aussi être un relais pour les attaques, sans le savoir. Et aussi, notre bande passante, qui coûte assez cher déjà, donc, va être exploitée pour des attaques. Donc il est essentiel qu'il y ait une collaboration entre gouvernement, secteur privé et société civile pour bien considérer la question de sécurité, notamment sur le plan réglementaire, sur le plan de la formation et de la sensibilisation, et aussi sur le plan de solutions techniques. Je citerai aussi que, au niveau de la sécurité des transactions, en Tunisie, nous avons une législation donc, par rapport au commerce électronique et à tout ce qui est sécurité et certification. Donc, nous avons une autorité de certification, un tiers de confiance, qui utilise l'infrastructure à clé publique. Nous avons aussi lancé un forum d'infrastructures à clé publique, Public Key Infrastructure, pour l'Afrique. Et donc nous espérons que tous les pays africains puissent tirer profit du commerce électronique. Toutefois, aujourd'hui, au niveau des standards, pour pouvoir reconnaître ces tiers de confiance, pour qu'il y ait aussi un échange au niveau international, il existe uniquement deux standards internationaux pour tout ce qui est procédure et politique pour ces tiers de confiance. C'est essentiel qu'il y ait une harmonisation en termes de standards et de normes pour qu'on ait un niveau de confiance assez et une reconnaissance au niveau international. Il est essentiel que les pays en voie de développement et les pays émergents puissent adhérer à cette questions de sécurité. Je finirai par dire qu'en Tunisie, donc, nous avons travaillé sur la législation aussi pour, par rapport au cybercrime. Donc c'est essentiel pour, pouvoir, pour que tout le monde puisse travailler sur cette question de sécurité. Je vous remercie.
Now, Christine, will you please?
Good afternoon. As we have all seen this week in the security sessions and in security panels, we are talking about security in several levels, and we need policies and we need legislation, but we need technical measures. And as I come from a CERT, from an instant response team, I'm going to focus on some of the technical issues that were not talked here this week, that are some of the fundamental causes of several problems we are having today that need to be of concern of governments, of civil society, of operators and everybody. So as an instant response team, we see all the problems during our day-to-day work. We help networks to recover, to mitigate, to try to not have a big impact in the day-to-day attacks that they see. And we try to do post-mortem analysis and try to see what happened, what caused those problems, why we had this worm and that bot and that vulnerability, why we had that compromise, what is the actual biggest problem that is causing all this. And we are training people here to try to deal with this problem, but we are actually focusing a lot on training. So we are getting people that are already there, already doing the network and security. But I would like to say that most of the problems we have today, they are there, out there in the, our area for more than 20 years now. So we have some basic problems in the software development. We have some basic problems in the implementation of protocols. So these are some of the major problems that we can only solve if we think about how we are going to prepare our next generation ICT professionals. So how are universities today teaching about how to think about security when you are designing a system, how to think about security when you are implementing a system or implementing a protocol or implementing a standard? Because at the end, we can come up with protocols and standards and a lot of solutions, but if they are poorly implemented, if they have problems and security problems in their coding and in their design, we will still have problems and we will still have worms and we will have someone trying to exploit the very technology that we are using to protect ourselves. So one of the things that I think we need to think about is how we introduce security mindset, as to speak, or to have really people in that are in the engineering schools, computer science schools, and actually preparing our professionals for ICT to think about security in the whole process. And not actually thinking about secure coding or secure development, or thinking about, okay, I'm doing this now, this network, this protocol, this standard, but where is it going to be implemented? There will be someone interested in attacking that. Am I using good practice to implement it? And think that you have people implementing those systems. So they make mistakes, and you can still have problems arising for that. But if they are, since the beginning, being taught to actually have security in mind and thinking about the security problems that we could have, we could mitigate. We will not have a perfect world or a perfect protocols or internet, but we will have less problems and maybe we could deal and manage better the problems that we have. So I'm not actually talking about critical infrastructures or instant response as a whole. I think we all need to leverage from the certs that are already out there, from the technical operators and the technical community that's already there doing a lot of work and cooperating and solving the problems. But we need also to think about the future and how to prepare the next generation professionals. And we have all the internet and we have, at the end, all those problems migrating for cell phones, for 3G, for the next generation of networks. So just to have this in mind too, that we need to deal with the problems now and with all the attacks, but we need to prepare the next generation professionals too. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Christine. Now, let me turn to Jamil.
Hi, Honorable Chair, Mr. Secretary. I come from Pakistan. I'm a lawyer. And in my country, you must have seen in the news that terrorism fraud, money laundering, these sort of things are a major issue. And the government is making efforts trying to fight those. I'm just going to sort of give you a brief as to how cybercrime and the convention of cybercrime and legislation has an impact in developing countries, so bear with me for a moment. The example of Daniel Pearl, the U.S. journalist who was unfortunately kidnapped and murdered in Pakistan, was an example where the only way investigation agencies could really trace down to find out who the kidnappers was to use cyber forensics. Unfortunately, at that time, use of certain cyber crimes, which were used as part of aiding and abetting this exercise, were not crimes at that moment. So we had to come up with new legislation. I wrote the Electronic Transactions Ordinance in 2002. But obviously, that was not enough. And the government has been now trying to come up with the cybercrime law. Now, while this was going on, we gave them the Cybercrime Convention as a model. And I must say that while this effort was going on, at the same time when I was in Athens, and I'm focusing on the enhanced cooperation aspect of the IGF and how important these sort of meetings are, we were able to get the Council of Europe to actually get interested and involved in this process. That was excellent. It created capacity building awareness and also brought technical knowledge to many of the people. Now, interestingly enough, it wasn't just government. It was business and civil society in Pakistan that were able to sort of talk with some knowledge about this issue and then lobby government. Various aspects about the balancing of openness against security, where's the right balance, looking at issues as liability of ISPs, costs of compliance, copyright infringement, and the most important, Article 15 of that convention, procedural safeguards, independent judicial supervision. These are very, very important to us. And this is process still going on. But it was difficult to say, look, we are not in government, we're not policymakers, but we're business and civil society. So how did we make it happen? After a lot of lobbying, things still weren't being heard. What we actually did was put a lot of this stuff on YouTube. And the moment it went onto YouTube, a lot of what it means, not just the legal jargon, what it means to the common man, to an artist, to a journalist, to a media person, what does it mean to have this sort of a draconian legislation as it was in that draft form earlier, and not comply with the Council of Europe Convention, not comply with safeguards, and not have harmonious definitions. Obviously, that would not assist in the fight against cybercrime, fight against cyberterrorism. Those are the sort of things we came up with. And I think there you saw civil society and APC and ICC bases really cooperate and come together. I think it was an excellent enhanced cooperation idea. As far as this process led to a lot of discussion on compatible legislation, we said, oh, obviously, if we're going to have someone we pick up, we spend a lot of money on investigation, take him to court, and then find that the crime he's being tried for in Pakistan is not the same definition as abroad, but the investigation happened someplace else, that man is going to go free. So the harmonious definitions are very important. The one thing we need to find is basically as harmonious legislation. I want to concentrate on that point as I'm speaking, because the Council of Europe Convention pretty much is the only document we have. And I think that is the first step that we need to focus on. Other aspects, other efforts, I think we need to start realizing that this is the key point. We need to all sort of come together and say, all right, this is the first foundation. Sure, there can be things that can be done in addition to that. We've seen the Western democracies and seen basically big economies sign the Cybercrime Convention. The U.S. ratification, I think, was a very important step in that direction. But now it comes to developing countries, where these originate from, the other side of the coin. And in that respect, I think that the Council of Europe outreach program, the Council of Europe Convention's outreach program, to go into these countries and to get them to sign up and ratify will be extremely important. Any other efforts to delay this by creating confusion, by saying there are several other processes, will only delay the harmonious, effective fight against cyberterrorism and against cybercrimes. And I think that is very important. One last point I would like to stress upon is that I don't think it is, in response to a certain point made earlier, it is not the mandate of the ITU to regulate the internet. And I think that is something that has been stated by the General Secretary earlier when he did take office. So I think that needs to be sort of considered in this whole context as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Saheed. We are inviting questions from the floor. I see quite a few people coming in after we started. Would you submit the papers with question, your name, and affiliation? We have already some questions. I would like to invite first a couple of questions. Will you please identify yourself, and then if you have certain person to you want to be answered, would you please give us a name? First, I would like to have Alan Michael. Oh, yes. Microphone to the floor, please.
Thank you very much. I just want to make the point that whenever there's a problem, the public demand more laws, more regulation. And the problem is that laws rarely prevent what they forbid. And the speed and penetration of the internet means that a traditional approach can never keep up. So we must agree, mustn't we, that we need a cleverer approach. Too often, security is an add-on, and that's useless. Security and enterprise development must be developed together, as Christine Hooper said in her contribution. So that means that industry has to take the lead in tackling crime and nuisance on the internet, but they have to do it in partnership with civil society and government. The way I'd put it is that being accountable is the price for not having heavy and bureaucratic legislation and regulation. So the answer to Marco Gerk's challenge is not more laws, not legislation, it's cooperative governance. So in the UK, we're establishing a crime reduction partnership with industry lead, but overseen by the four-part governance of parliamentarians, civil society, that is NGOs, along with government and industry. And the focus has to be on the needs of citizens, that is on all users, not just big users, and their concerns. Isn't that the way forward?
Yeah, Mark?
Thank you very much. An excellent comment, and I would like to pick out one of the challenges that law enforcement agencies are actually currently facing to further develop what you just said, cooperation on a technical level from the industry as well as law. Take encryption technology. If as an offender you're using encryption technology and you have a proper password, it is nearly impossible to break the encryption in an adequate time. So there are a number of possibilities how we can address it. We can have technical solutions or we can have legal solutions. And if we're talking about legal solutions, we need a balance. And therefore, I'm very happy that you pointed out the UK, because the UK has just undertaken legal measures that I cannot accept from a civil liberties perspective. What the UK is just, with the regulation of investigatory power, the third part, has just come into place, and that allows law enforcement agencies to order anybody who is using encryption technology and the suspect of a crime to hand out the password. And if he refuses to cooperate, even though the law enforcement agencies are not able to prove that he committed a crime, he can be sent to justice by only refusing to cooperate and hand out the password. So that's a legal approach where I can fully agree to your position. We don't need those laws. We don't need overregulation. But we need a legal basis. Because take spam. The industry did not effectively fight against spam on their own. So we need, at the end, if we're realizing it doesn't work to prevent it, then we need at least the law to be able to prosecute those offenders. That's the last step. I don't want overregulation. Let me make this clear. We don't need additional laws if there are laws in place. I don't want the internet to be more regulated than outside the internet, but we have criminal laws in place outside the internet, so I just want the same kind of protection inside the internet. And last point, within finding this balance, we're in a process. We did not yet find it. And when people in 30 years will look back, they might say, well, there were challenges, but you did too much. There was too much legislation in place. I don't want this. I want us to find the balance and discuss that.
Thank you, Marco. One more question I'm picking up is from Gadi Evron. Will you be brief and articulate, please?
You know me already. Thank you very much. I see you know me already. Thank you very much. My name is Gadi Evron, and I'm with Ophelius. I would like to make two quick points about the process that I've seen in the past few days in the IGF. First of all, thank you all for being in the panel and expressing what you have, and for China for admitting internal problems and showing visibility that we have not seen before, leading the way here. We appreciate it. Thank you. We have two problems. I come from the operational and technical community, people who have basically been cooperating, have been cooperating globally nonstop for several years. When we talk about establishing communication, when we talk about information sharing, when we talk about problems, these already exist. My goal here is to try and find the regulators, the policymakers, and tell them, I don't know how to talk to you. We don't know how to talk to you. We have real problems. Our problems are, for example, complete inability to work across borders, being back channels ourselves for law enforcement, as well as we lack leadership. We can lead ourselves, but when it comes down to it, we cannot in any way rely on goodwill-based relationships to keep the internet together for that much longer. And thankfully, the internet is not going to die tomorrow. But what I would like to request from the panel is your take on how can we can potentially, hopefully, reach a better understanding between the people who actually do this daily, international cooperation on a very large scale, and how can we move what we do to your level? How can we communicate? And a second short part of this is, with the emergence of large-scale attacks, such as in Estonia, and with the impact that these have on economies, how do you see that critical infrastructure changes, and how do you believe this can be impacted when the infrastructure used for these attacks is basically the same infrastructure as cybercrime, and so far we have been far behind and losing? Thank you very much.
Are you addressing the question to? Okay. Is anyone ready to answer the question? Yes, please.
I'm not exactly an expert on how to fight them, but I would say the three basic steps, which I can highlight, and I'm sure other people would add to this. Number one, I think you need to reduce the safe havens that exist globally. And the way to do that, and maybe repetitive in what I'm saying, is to bring in harmonized legislation that criminalizes the acts that we're talking about. I think that's the first step. The second would be, because you need to get rid of competitive advantage in being in a different location and, you know, being able to do this crime, because it becomes a financial benefit to the people who do it. The second is awareness. I think that was mentioned on the panel here earlier in the opening remarks. And the third is better technology, encouraging business to be able to handle that. So I think these are the three basic things that need to be done, at least. And one last point, I think, was mentioned in one of the workshops yesterday. You need to train law enforcement, and you need to train your judiciary. I think that in most developing countries, you've got this very serious problem. Sometimes the investigatory authorities are being, you know, they're getting funding, et cetera, but the Interior Ministry pays them, et cetera. But some, and in my country, for instance, they didn't have a budget for 7 years. The CERT there was literally without a budget for 7 years. Only now maybe they'll get it. And that's just an example. But as far as access to justice and training judges is concerned, who actually have to understand this problem, it's just really not even there in most places in my region. So I think that needs to be done.
Well, other than panelists, we invited six experts of this field who are sitting in the first row. Let me introduce from Izumi, Aizu. Yes, and Anne Kablan. And Georg Grieb. Malcolm Haber. Katica Rodriguez. Yes, five of them are here. And I would like to invite two of the discussants, challengers. First, Izumi, are you
okay?
Ready to?
My name is Izumi Aizu, and I've been on the ICANN's at Large Advisory Committee for more than 4 years to bring the individual users' voices to this ICANN process. So having done that, I think I know a little bit about the individual users, maybe, but on the security, first of all, how many of you know how many people killed by traffic accident every year?
It depends on where you are.
There's some official statistics. Vint?
At least 150,000 people a year, maybe more.
Thank you very much. 1.2 million. Okay. Of which 15%, according to some news, is in China. But it's... So why do we talk about the cybersecurity? At least, as far as I know, there was nobody killed on the internet. Maybe the use, yes, it's getting more serious by the use of the internet. But at least the internet doesn't directly kill people, but still we need to work on that. Well, to skip the rationale, my just one comment is I agree with most of the speakers that we really need to have a global framework, especially on the policy and the governance side, if not only the operation. Operational side research guys are doing a great job, although we have only one cert in Africa and very few in the developing countries. But we really need this multi-stakeholder approach to be more enhanced into the security policies. And as somebody you said about the leadership, I haven't really seen the strong initiative to bring all these guys together from north and south, from civil society and experts, law enforcement. They somehow are still in some isolated islands. That's my view. If you have any response to that, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Mark.
Just a very quick one. The example with traffic accidents is excellent from my point of view, and I'm often referring to that as well. But I'm going to ask you another question. How many percent of U.S. businesses do you think believe that the costs or the damages caused by cybercrime are more than by traditional crimes? It's 60%. And I'm not a great fan of statistics when it comes to the internet damages, but if you just have a look at the estimate losses caused by identity theft in the United States or by virus attacks just in the year 2003, which was more than $10 billion, I think we might come to the conclusion that not because of only of protecting life and health, we need to ensure that we have sufficient laws in place. But let me just take the life that you mentioned before. We have an expert here from the Council of Europe who was just involved in drafting recommendations for internet medicine or how you can order internet medicine. There are many people dying because they're ordering medicine on the internet, which turns out to be fake products. So maybe you should include that in the statistics.
Okay. Anne, it's your turn. Do you have the microphone?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the panelists for this very interesting discussion. I work for the OECD. The OECD is an intergovernmental organization which works with business and increasingly with civil society. We are at the origin of this expression, developing a culture of security. The OECD does not develop binding instruments, especially in this area, but instruments that try to help develop a kind of new mindset so that people would, all participants would have a role in security. The panel said very interesting things. I noted that there's not 100% security, which is possible, that we have security at different levels, which makes things difficult, that there are legal, technical, educational responses, and that cooperation is needed. So I come to my question. Different models for cooperation are possible. Top-down, bottom-up, a mix of both. Very inclusive, all participants, less inclusive, led by governments, collaborative with governments, business, and civil society. So could the panel tell us what they think the best model would be to ensure security more than today, to reduce cyber criminality online, and to enhance trust? Thank you.
Maybe Kristen? Okay.
I think if it was easy to have like a global, international, and broad cooperation, we probably would be doing that. But some of the success cases that we see, usually when you see people cooperating, it's among a common problem or some common point that they actually would like to see solved or something like that. One of the things that we see today is that you have some societies that I like fighting anti-phishing, and then they are doing the same things that some organizations that are fighting spam, and then they are doing the same things that the certs are doing. And then we have still other organizations trying to do what the same very organizations are already doing. So one of the things that I would suggest is someone need to look out there and to see where's the gap. If we have already a lot of people cooperating into the technical level and cooperating to fight phishing or spam or trying to come up with that, that probably is that gap. And one of the things I think Katie said that we have a lot of people talking in the political level and a lot of people already cooperating in the technical level, but needs a link between that. And one of the panelists said about awareness, and some of the time is really not only awareness, but speaking the same language, because we sometimes are trying to achieve the same goal, but we are not necessarily reaching each other or being in the same pace. So I don't think that there is a secret, but we see, especially with CERTs, what we do is we try to cooperate in what we can. We try to fill gaps in technical shortage that the teams have. So we try to provide knowledge. We try to share content that we develop. And this is kind of not so formal cooperation, but really works for us to share that kind of information. So maybe one of the things that we should look for is where are the gaps and how to get really more the policymakers and political level to talk with the technical people that are actually already doing a lot of contingency and the work in the internet. Anyone else? I don't know.
Yes, Rolf? Yes, Rolf?
I would add to that that probably sometimes it's important to have a clear differentiation of the specific functions. I would guess that you rather have a very, very good and global coordination of the technical community and not have too many policymakers mess with your business, right? And probably the other way around. I think that we have to make clear what, at which level the solutions are appropriate and not if there's a problem anywhere, call for new laws or call for technical solutions if there's social problems. And another thing is I would also urge the panel and the audience here to be really clear about what we're talking about. And this got a bit confused here when this example of medicine sold online and so on and people maybe dying because of that was brought. I'm not sure if that really is an example of cybercrime. That's an example of the existence of a black market for medicine or fake medicine. That's a completely different problem. The same, I would say, is true for child pornography. The problem with child pornography is that there are children that are exploited and really, really evil and ugly things happen to them, but it's not because of the internet, and it's not a specific internet problem. We had similar discussions in the World Summit negotiations when there was some language introduced on money laundering for terrorist purposes and so on, and we as civil society said, this is not really a problem for internet governance, it's a problem for financial oversight, and there are already structures for that. So I'm a bit afraid that whenever crime that's happening offline also, that has been around for ages, and we never have been able to get rid of that 100%, just because this is also brought to the online world and to the internet now, that we look at it from a different perspective and try to come up with technical solutions and things like that.
Thank you, Rolf. Marco?
It was my example, so I just wanted to quickly jump in. Absolutely right, I agree. This is not a cybercrime. It's like I've recently heard somebody saying in the news that it's a cybercrime if you hit somebody with a keyboard. For sure not. But what we have to take into consideration is the fact that the internet enables a number of ways of distribution that we do not have in the real world. So it makes it, for example, possible to hide your identity in a different way. So we need different instruments, and we need to address those challenges. We don't need new laws in that case. So child pornography, if it covers files as well as printed material, that's absolutely sufficient. But when we talk about medicine, we just have to take into consideration that it is not the regular ways of distribution only, but it is done on the internet. So we are talking about illegal content. And we should just ensure that we are able to address those instruments, that those offenses in the internet. And some countries, especially those with an old legal tradition, do not have the instruments in place at the moment. They sometimes really focus on tangible items, what we don't have in the internet. So that is, from my point of view, what we should just ensure.
Well, with me, I have a question from Emily Taylor concerning the meaning of security. Emily, are you not clear yet?
Thank you. In a multi-stakeholder preparatory meeting held in London last month, security was identified almost unanimously as the most important of the IGF themes for a UK audience. The discussions focused on security as meaning trust and confidence in online commercial transactions. What do the panelists understand the term security to mean in the IGF context?
Who are you? Whom are you addressing the question? Anybody? Yeah, maybe going down from Zahid.
I think that's in my understanding of the IGF forum. I think that is a rather narrow definition of what security might mean. I think for developing countries, and as in particular context of the IGF, security could mean a whole lot of other things. It's not just that particular aspect, and that is precisely what you see here. So, I mean, I know that the question's a little sort of broad. That's why, you know, what would we mean by that? And I don't want to sort of take it away from other people, but in my view, obviously the legislation is an aspect. Cooperation, international cooperation is an aspect. Making sure that you have standards in the business community itself to be able to self-regulate, for instance, as an addition to that. In fact, the structures of NICs themselves would also come into play. But obviously that was not what was identified in London at that point. I'll let others follow from this.
Yes, Lamia.
Donc, d'après la question, moi, je voudrais parler du concept de sécurité. Je pense qu'il s'agit ici de protéger aussi bien les systèmes, les réseaux d'une nation, d'un pays, mais voire aussi au niveau international. Donc là, on a les systèmes informatiques, les applications, par exemple, les applications des gouvernements ou des banques. Il y a aussi la protection des réseaux donc, qui existent au niveau d'un pays, mais aussi la protection des individus par rapport à ce qu'ils ont. Et là, donc, il y a une question de perte. Qui peuvent provenir de ces des attaques qui peuvent venir soit des virus ou par exemple de d'usurpation d'identité ou autre. Donc là, il faut voir au niveau d'un pays. Moi, je pense que tout à l'heure, il y avait la question par rapport à la coopération internationale, mais il est essentiel aussi qu'il y ait une stratégie au niveau déjà national. C'est-à-dire, il faut qu'il y ait une conscience de l'importance de cette question de sécurité, aussi bien au niveau des gouvernements, des politiques, mais aussi au niveau du secteur privé et de la société civile. Et c'est avec les trois partenaires travaillant ensemble qu'on peut atteindre un objectif de sécurité. En Tunisie, en l'occurrence, donc nous travaillons beaucoup, par exemple, sur la formation d'auditeurs de sécurité, c'est-à-dire il faut qu'il y ait des compétences pour venir auditer des systèmes, s'assurer de la santé des réseaux, des applications, etc., pour être sûr que nous sommes en train de protéger c'est-à-dire toutes les richesses informatiques que nous avons. Voilà ce que je voulais rajouter. Merci.
Thank you, Lamia. Cheng Kin, the question is, how do you understand the term security in the context of IGF?
My understanding is that security is a balance. 那么事先呀，预防是必要条件，但是还不充分，特别是网络安全。事前的预防啊是非常重要，包括它采取一些技术手段，是吧？一些法律措施。但是呢，这是必要条件，不充分。更重要的，我觉得是要建立一旦发生事件以后的应急响应这样的组织或者这样的机制。一旦发现了以后，出现这样问题，怎么来尽快的解决它，把损失减到最小。
我认为安全分两个层面，一个是事前预防，一个事后的话呢，怎么来尽快的处理，把损失减到最小。我觉得从两个层面来解决，我是这么来看。谢谢。Well, I have still three discussants in line. Georg, will you please?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation, for being here. Thank you very much for the very interesting presentations, many of which I found extremely interesting, I have to say. There is a couple of things that I am tempted to comment upon, including spam and the question of paper crime versus cyber crime, but having a technical background, allow me to give my personal experience on the issue of security. And that revolves largely around the relationship between security and transparency and control. Ralph said that security is control over the future, and in fact, I found that rather fitting. And I would also agree with Ms. Hoopers on the educational aspect of technology. In my experience, transparency ultimately is one of the key factors to security, because while security through obscurity may seem logical, it is a fundamentally flawed concept. We can show this through mathematics. There is Auguste Kerckhoff, a mathematician, who has proven that a system that relies on secrecy for its security is inherently less secure. But you can also explain this in normal human speech. Think about a lock and a key. When you have transparency in the technology, in the design, you are discussing in a transparent and open way how to design a lock, how to create a locking mechanism. So we can create the best locking mechanism and we can find the flaws it has to fix them. That does not necessarily mean we hand out the key to the lock we put into our houses. And that hooks into the procedural issue, because in order to be able to engage in this process of fixing the mechanism, we must create awareness for this ultimately from the early start on. We don't want to redo the whole lock after finding out that our design was fundamentally flawed. And the second part is about control of the software we are running, because ultimately the internet, every application, our operating systems, all of this is software. If we do not have control over the software, we cannot control our environment. That is why, from my experience, for instance, free software, software that has the fundamental four freedoms to use, study, modify, and distribute, that gives it to all users, is the most sustainable choice in the long run, because you can never lose the control over this software. So my question to the panelists would be, A, do you have a response to this? And B, what do you think does this mean for our policies and our procurement choices when we talk about internet technology? Thank you.
Is anyone ready to answer? Oh, yes. Zahid?
Thank you. This is the open source argument, and the argument that open source is the only secure mechanism of having security. First of all, I don't know about the analogy starting with the whole preconceived notion that it, something's broken. I don't know about it being broken at the moment. I think we're evolving. So yes, we need solutions to problems that arise on a daily basis, and so how people use cyber world and the internet, etc. But coming more to your point, I think, especially from a developing country point of view, we are, like India, like China and others, approaching a stage where we would like outsourcing to come to our country. We would like to be able to develop software. And so the next stage in the 21st century is not about industries alone. It's going to be about innovation. The countries that innovate are going to be able to grow economically. In order to make that happen, innovation has to be protected as well. The incentives in my country, for instance, in Pakistan, for a software developer who is not able to take advantage of his software, whose software can be transferred to somebody else, maybe in India, etc., or China, then I think that will have a very major impact. At least it's a vested interest for a developing country. So from a developing country point of view, which is usually not the case when this argument is made, I think it's a very important aspect that the intellectual property rights to software should be protected. I think that open source is not the only solution. It can be a very good solution for certain aspects, but not the only, and that doesn't mean that we should get rid of intellectually proprietary software. And so I think that that's an important area that developing countries are going to have to concentrate on for their economic growth. I know also, and I'm sorry I'm sort of carrying on here, but I know also that there are a lot of policies being developed by government for open source, but basically what they end up doing is ensuring that those proprietary softwares which could be offered to those countries, which are also secure, maybe of a better quality also sometimes, cannot even participate in those tenders. But that's a way of keeping people out. And when you keep people out and you keep the best practices out from growing economies, what ends up happening is we don't learn from that. And technical assistance and quality doesn't come to those countries sometimes. And I've seen that happen sometimes in my country's bidding. Thank you.
Rolf, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I won't go into the free software debate, but maybe say something about your first argument, the relationship between security and transparency. You can even take that analogy further. We from the privacy community are of course very afraid of overly intrusive and overly broad surveillance mechanisms, and especially because many of those are not transparent. You know, that's not especially related to cybercrime and internet security, but of course a lot of data collection on individuals and profiling and so on happens because they go to the internet and do stuff there and leave their data there. And then you sometimes get a higher interest rate for your consumer credit. Some people end up on no-fly lists. Sometimes spam, no spam, I mean, sometimes normal, legitimate email gets eaten by spam filters. And people just don't know why this is the case and how they can prevent it, what they can do about it, because a lot of these mechanisms are not transparent and are not open. And that's, in a way, the asymmetry that's created if you address security problems by surveillance, because most of the surveillance schemes are not transparent.
Now, let me introduce a question from, yes, Marco?
Yep. Very quickly.
Very brief, yes.
Thank you so much. I think technical solutions can be a solution for the challenges that we are facing with regard to security, so no question. But I think that open source is the only solution or the one solution is from my point of view not right. If we would get somebody from Microsoft to stand here next to you, he would have given us so many good arguments for keeping those mechanisms secret. And I mean, it's if we're looking at the internet infrastructure and we look at the servers, I mean, I don't want to offend Microsoft, but I have my doubts that many of them are working with a Microsoft operating system, that we're using Linux for them. And nevertheless, we're facing difficulties, we're facing challenges. So open software is for sure something we need to discuss, but with regard to security as a main argument, I find it pretty difficult.
Thank you. Let me introduce, yes.
Merci. Permettez-moi de rajouter donc une remarque par rapport justement à la sécurité des produits logiciels ou matériels aujourd'hui. Donc il y a une conscience par rapport aux enjeux justement de sécurité des produits qui sont délivrés aux clients. Aujourd'hui, il existe des standards et des normes. Je citerai notamment la méthodologie d'évaluation critères communs, donc qui est adoptée par différents pays au monde aujourd'hui et qui permet en fait d'évaluer le niveau de sécurité d'un produit logiciel ou matériel. Toutefois, c'est le suivi de ces méthodologies est assez coûteux, c'est-à-dire qu'il faut que le pays dispose de laboratoires d'évaluation selon ces méthodologies-là, qui sont assez difficiles, surtout si on veut atteindre un niveau de sécurité assez élevé. Et donc là, pour des pays, par exemple, en voie de développement, il est très difficile aujourd'hui de faire passer donc une évaluation d'un produit pour qu'il soit reconnu et vendu au niveau international. Et c'est vraiment un enjeu pour nous. Nous avons déjà abordé la question, par exemple, en Tunisie. Et donc, instaurer un laboratoire d'évaluation avec donc, un niveau de sécurité élevé, type critères communs ou FIPS, donc aux États-Unis. Donc là, c'est vraiment assez coûteux. Et donc là, on voit qu'il y a des enjeux aussi pour les pays en développement. Merci.
Let me get one question from the floor. Alexander Untko? Oh, yes, please. You are from IDU, I understand. Yep.
Okay. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. I've heard a lot about, you know, what IT should do and what IT shouldn't do. But I think our colleague there from Pakistan should, as a lawyer, you should know that this is not the venue or the forum to discuss the mandate of ITU. And ITU has never mentioned that it is going to regulate the internet. So I think maybe you should focus on the areas where you have competence and leave intergovernmental politics to those who can deal with it. Thanks.
Can I respond to that? I think my dear friends, maybe there's a misunderstanding. There was a comment made earlier today that the ITU should regulate. I don't know if you had your translator on, but that was somebody who made a comment on the panel that ITU should regulate the internet. This comment was made on the panel. It was up here as well. And I was responding to that, saying the ITU's mandate is not that it should regulate. This is not something that they've decided. I'm agreeing with you, and you're agreeing with me.
I have quite a few questions with me, and also two discussants in line. Malcolm, would you have your comments or question?
Thank you, Chairman. Malcolm Harbour. I'm a member of the European Parliament, so many of the issues that we've talked about in terms of policymaking do come in my direction. And so I just want to make a few observations, I think, about the sort of public policy priorities and how we move forward. There's been a lot of interesting points made about the real impact of lack of security on consumer confidence, people using the internet, and on criminal activities. I think that the one thing that we wouldn't dispute is that the use of the internet for certain types of criminal activities has made them easier. But more importantly, it's moved them onto an international scale in a way that we've never seen before. And therefore, I agree with a number of the panelists who've talked about issues around having, if you like, some common definition standards and the possibilities to prosecute and deal with people across borders. But the fact remains is you've got to catch them in the first place. And I think that the area where we need to continue to step up our international collaborative efforts has got to be at the operational level. It's all very well having a harmonized legal system, but if you haven't actually got the information and speedy flows of information to deal and stop criminal activities, no matter how many wonderful legal provisions you have in place, you're never going to catch anybody. And so that, I think, is the most crucial area. And there are a number of initiatives being taken, things like the London Agreement, which hasn't been discussed very much here. But it seems to me that the international community needs to step up its operational collaboration, its reporting systems, its computer emergency response teams, some of the things we've talked about here. And those are sort of the imperatives that we, at a political level, members of Parliament, are entitled to ask for that to be stepped up. But of course, I think there are broader and more critical issues to be dealt with, because we all know that our societies in all countries, certainly in developed economies more so than others, are becoming entirely reliant on resilient, and I think that's an important word we haven't heard, resilient and secure information technology networks. We had a little analogy earlier on, a bit of a debate about, you know, how important internet security is in terms of personal health and welfare. I mean, all I would say is that if somebody determinedly attacked the air traffic control system in any one region and managed to disable it for half an hour, we would be facing an extremely dangerous situation. So the critical security, the critical infrastructure does need to be protected, and that's an area where we also need to step up more international collaboration, because that is absolutely international. And where do we need the redundancies? Where are the weak spots? And there is a lot of collaboration going on. It's not something that will be done publicly and very transparently, because we don't necessarily want people to know about that. But again, I think we are entitled to ask for that to be stepped up. And those of you that have studied what went on in Estonia, a member of the European Union, the cyber attack there, we'll see exactly what sort of damage can potentially be done to an economy unless we have those sort of resilience measures in place. And I would suggest that is a priority that we need to move on and look at.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. Let me introduce Katica Rodriguez. Will you please?
It's complex. Okay. My name is My name is Katica Rodriguez. I'm International Policy Fellow of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Diplo Foundation Fellow. I like the exposition that everybody, I will speak in Spanish, sorry, que todo el mundo el día de hoy hicieron los expositores. Yo quiero centrarme a un punto especial. Creo que me gustó el remarque que hizo el expositor Vendra cuando citó que no hay, la seguridad es la que está centrada en los usuarios. Yo creo que no hay seguridad si no hay, no existe seguridad si no hay privacidad. Y se necesita una seguridad sin intrusión, una seguridad con privacidad. Es indudable que con el correr de los años la posibilidad de disponer de información personal ha ido paulatinamente en aumento. Si a ello se le suma la interconexión en bases de datos, el análisis estadístico a través de mecanismos de data mining, nuestra información de nuestra información personal, determinando nuestros patrones de consumo, nuestras preferencias de consumo, surge muchos cuestionamientos con relación al derecho a la persona y a protegerse frente a la intromisión de los demás. El régimen de protección de los datos personales permite a que los ciudadanos ejerzan su legítimo poder de disposición y control sobre los datos de carácter personal referidos a la persona, que se encuentran en bases de datos de titularidad de terceros. Lamentablemente en el Perú y muchos países en el mundo, estas bases de datos se encuentran pululando por la Internet y en el mercado negro, y lo encuentras con datos con los datos de nuestro salario, nombre, dirección, el registro electoral, la licencia de conducir y a menos de $10. Yo me pregunto, ¿esto no expone al robo de identidad y no creen que los estados deberían centrarse en aprobar leyes de protección de datos, así como hacer que esas leyes se hagan cumplir, lo que se conoce en inglés como el enforcement de la ley? Y una segunda pregunta, y disculpen, mi computadora se malogró y no he podido leer las preguntas que yo había escrito. La segunda es con relación a Hopper, es con relación a la educación y seguridad. Estamos de acuerdo en que la educación y herramientas que protejan la privacidad y seguridad de la información y comunicación son necesarias siempre y cuando éstas protejan la seguridad de las comunicaciones y la privacidad de los usuarios, lo que se conoce como Privacy Engaging Technology. Mi pregunta es, ¿no cree usted que si bien la educación es necesaria, también es sumamente importante que los gobiernos aprueben normas de protección de datos y garanticen una efectiva observancia de la ley? Segundo, yo quisiera citar un ejemplo. En varios países en Sudamérica, el respeto al derecho a la privacidad y el secreto de las comunicaciones es una cuestión de vida o muerte. Periodistas, trabajadores de derechos humanos, bloggers que presentan opiniones discrepantes del gobierno terminan siendo asesinados por dar una opinión independiente. En ese sentido, ¿no cree usted que es necesario la educación en el uso de este tipo de herramientas de Privacy Engaging Technology que proteja la privacidad y el secreto de las comunicaciones frente a la vigilancia ilegítima del correo electrónico, navegación e internet y el almacenamiento de nuestra información guardada en nuestra computadora? Gracias.
Is anyone ready to take?
Thank you. I think that's very important. I, as a developing country, I completely agree with you. We need to sort of sophisticate our legislation and our government's role in this. I'll give you an example. In my country, I mean, I know your data is on the black market, but in my country, for instance, the National Data Registration Authority actually sells that data to people who would like to buy it. It's a major privacy issue. And actually, at the moment, I'm working on a legislation to deal with these privacy issues. But I know that in our region, this is a major aspect. So I thank you for raising that aspect. That is, I think, linked to security, definitely. And I hadn't thought about the journalists that you talked about. I think that's a very important issue. I just wanted to agree with you there.
Well, I would just like to point out the importance of developing countries again, and that was something where I would like to come to your point. I think in Europe the situation might be different, and we can really start concentrating on other aspects apart from law. So we can really start, when we were talking about Estonia, to analyze technical issues and try to prevent that. But when it comes to developing countries, the situation is different, because what does it help you if you can technically trace things down, if you cannot fight against those offenders based in your country that are actually responsible for that? And the classic example is the Philippines, where we've just had a conference 2 weeks ago, and those national experts pointed out again, we were technically able to trace them back, but we were not able to prosecute them. So the legal point is, from my point, essential as well. And I think we have to be very aware of the special situation of developing countries. There were some books on the market, brought on the market in the last years, that were trying to focus on the developing countries and explain their special situation. I think not absolutely sufficient. So the ITU is trying this approach again, and I'm highly appreciating their approach to address the specific problems of developing countries with cybersecurity guides as well as cybercrime guides. So the educational aspect is, especially in those countries, very important, the legislative, and then we come finally to the technical solutions.
Thank you. I have several questions with me right now. I would like to have three questions and then give you some time to think over and answer to the questionnaires. First, Elena Batueva. Oh yes, in the middle.
Добрый вечер, Батуева Елена, Министерство иностранных дел Российской Федерации. Сегодня мы говорили о разных уровнях информационной безопасности, и я бы хотела дать комментарий по международной информационной безопасности. Очевидно,
Will you excuse me, repeat from the beginning, because we didn't have a translation, please. Okay. Would you start from the beginning?
Okay. I'll introduce myself. Елена Батуева, Министерство иностранных дел Российской Федерации. Do you have a translation? Okay. Сегодня мы говорили о разных уровнях информационной безопасности, и я хотела бы развить тему международного уровня информационной безопасности. Очевидно, что сегодня угрозы информационной безопасности представляют не только киберпреступники, кибертеррористы, но и государства. А средством достижения их целей является интернет. Когда мы говорим о государствах и осуществлении актов агрессии, здесь речь уже идет о национальной и даже международной информационной безопасности и стабильности. Значимость вопросов международной информационной безопасности была подтверждена на 62-й сессии Генеральной Ассамблеи ООН, когда практически единогласно проголосовали за резолюцию, продвигаемую Россией, под названием «Достижения в сфере информатизации и телекоммуникаций в контексте международной безопасности». Это подтверждает, что международная информационная безопасность и безопасность интернет, как ее неотъемлемая часть, содержит не только техническую, но и политико-военную составляющую, о которой мы здесь еще не говорили. И рассматривать нужно это все комплексно. Эти вопросы необходимо рассматривать в комплексе. В этой связи необходимо отметить также значимость предстоящей в 2009 году работы группы правительственных экспертов ООН по международной информационной безопасности. Мандат этой группы предусматривает продолжение исследования существующих и потенциальных угроз в сфере информационной безопасности и возможных совместных мер по их устранению. На наш взгляд, выработка общего подхода, международного подхода в сфере информационной безопасности в значительной степени упростит разработку соответствующих международных договоренностей, которых на данный момент не существует и которые, конечно же, должны быть выработаны. Спасибо.
I'll get two more questions. Just wait for two more questions coming in. Mr. Tomohiko Yamakawa? Yes. And then Mr. Pierre Dajino will follow. Yeah. Please, Mr. Yamakawa.
Thank you very much. My name is Yamakawa from NTT Data, representing Japan Business Federation, Nippon Keitan Len. As everybody knows that Nippon Keitan Len is the biggest Japanese business organization, consists of more than hundreds of companies, all kinds of businesses. On this May, Keitan Len has hosted an IGF regional meeting in Tokyo, inviting a secretary and other important persons to have a discussion. Even at this discussion, this issue, security, has recognized as the most important issue. From the perspective of business companies, as Dr. Marco Gerke has pointed out, that over-regulation would be the most biggest point. And my question is to Mr. Dr. Marco Gerke. One is, how shall we business organizations or business companies will be involved in the international corporations? If any good examples, please advise. The second one is over-regulation. We, Keitan Len, consists of all kinds of companies. For example, financial services, telecom operators, most of them are appointed as critical infrastructures. In such a case, our compliance is merged with the cooperation in cybersecurity. However, not companies which are not appointed as critical infrastructures, for example, simple manufacturers and service providers, they have obligation of compliance or self-regulations of information security. How shall we coexist to a requirement in one hand? Even if it's not just a business judgment, if any good rule or some international guidance, please advise. Thank you very much.
Next, Pierre Dagino. We have about 15 minutes to go and we have to be a little more effective. Oh yes, you're in the back.
Hello. Thanks very much. Well, at least one African country is well known as kind of originator of, you know, spamming attacks, but has put in place a structure and a strategy actually to fight, you know, against this sort of criminality. However, results are still not yet there. So my question here to all panelists would be, what form of sort of international collaboration we could put together to assist such a country, and also to which extent this IGF process could actually facilitate this. And also briefly on Tunisia, and that's for Lamia. Lamia, je suis assez surpris effectivement qu'un seul pays africain qui ait mis en place son CERT. Alors, je voudrais savoir quels sont rapidement les ingrédients, pourquoi la Tunisie a réussi, je crois que tu as commencé à les citer, mais surtout pour que tu puisses nous dire comment on peut justement amplifier ce mouvement au niveau continental. Et rapidement, si tu peux insister sur le rôle des différents acteurs, par exemple les régulateurs, est-ce qu'ils sont partie prenante? Merci.
Thank you very much. First Rolf, and then Marco and Lamia, okay, and then you may join. Okay, Rolf, please.
Yeah, I would like to reply to Katica and then to other comments here. And I think we had that discussion before, the issue of identity theft, and someone earlier also mentioned that the United States especially has a big problem with identity theft, and you mentioned Peru. I think there's a clear correlation if you look at the landscape of identity theft as one important cybercrime and privacy legislation. In countries where there's strong privacy legislation, the problem of identity theft is much, much smaller. That's a very easy solution, and as much as people here promote the spread of cybercrime legislation around the world, I would say if you want to do something against identity theft, you need to spread privacy regulation and legislation around the world. And there's also no global mechanism, no global institution for this, and this is maybe a problem. The other one is the lady from the Russian Federation and also Mr. Harbour. You mentioned the potential danger of international security. You mentioned the possibility of people hacking into air traffic control systems and so on. And that discussion has been around for quite a while. It was a bit overhyped in the 90s with lots of stories like electronic Pearl Harbor and, you know, hackers having more power at their fingertips than the nuclear bombing commands and so on. You have to be a bit sober about this, but I would say the approach to make sure that hacking and all the problems we have on the internet in terms of security, that doesn't spill over into the real world, in electricity systems, in traffic control systems, in water supply systems, and so on. The only solution to do that is to not connect these systems to the internet. I don't want these systems to be internet connected and controlled systems. And that basically means I don't want them to have. I don't want to have to discuss them here at the Internet Governance Forum. There might be other forums for this. But once you connect these kind of systems, or even power plants and so on, to the internet, you are in trouble.
Marco.
Sorry, I have immediate to react to that, because take a virus attack. If you're successful in sending out a virus and that affects the computer system of the check-in at an airport, you can maybe disconnect the tower from the internet, but it can affect the computers at a check-in, and that means you cannot check in anymore. We've seen while analyzing virus and worms attack that it affected a number of critical infrastructure. So it might be the fact that virus attacks are not that much focused, that they cannot really focus on one target as well as other attacks would be, but it is a great danger. So I think we should have instruments in place, apart from disconnecting part of our infrastructure from the internet, to secure it. But I would like to concentrate on another issue raised by our colleague from Japan, and that is the question how service providers should act, or how in general industry should act in this difficult field. And I'm currently co-chairing a working group from the Council of Europe on the question how should the industry and law enforcement agencies cooperate, how should they deal with each other. And I can tell you, you're in a terrible, difficult situation. So from my point of view, soft laws, recommendations are the one thing. But on the other hand side, I would like to have hard laws that are protecting service providers from responsibility where they simply cannot be made responsible. And I think it is a fundamental decision that we have to make. I mean, in the past, the decision was made in a number of countries that simply said we have to exclude certain service providers, certain infrastructure providers from responsibility. From a technical point of view, the situation might have changed. So maybe today they have the possibility of controlling. But the question that we now have to raise is not only do they have the capacity of controlling and can we make them responsible for that, but is the question, do we want them to control? So we will have to enter into this discussion again and have to find solutions. But I would prefer to have hard solutions, because what I'm realizing is we're criminalizing preparatory acts. We're criminalizing the production, for example, of devices that can be used to commit a crime. We're not waiting until the crime was committed anymore. We say we start earlier. And that's something that I find very dangerous. We should not go this any further. We should try to limit us on that way and try to concentrate on fighting against crime that had happened. So therefore, we need to protect the industry, but they have a responsibility as well.
Thank you. Lamir, and then Mr. Wan.
Lamir, please. No.
Lamir first.
Merci. Donc, je vais répondre à la question qui m'a été adressée concernant donc la Tunisie et donc le rôle du régulateur dans le domaine de la sécurité en général. Donc, premièrement, donc au niveau de la Tunisie, donc il y a eu mise en place de législation. Donc, il y a eu la loi sur le commerce électronique et la création d'une agence de certification électronique pour l'accréditation de tiers de confiance pour le volet sécurité des transactions. Donc, l'authentification, la confidentialité, l'intégrité des transactions et la non-répudiation. Donc, là, c'est pour le volet transaction. Sur le plan sécurité informatique, il y a eu aussi une loi donc, permettant d'instaurer un niveau de sécurité au niveau des
des grandes applications. Il y a même une obligation d'audit de sécurité au niveau des applications gouvernementales et au niveau des grandes institutions comme le secteur bancaire. Et donc, il y a l'Agence nationale de sécurité informatique qui a comme rôle de jouer le rôle de CERT, donc le Computer Emergency Response Team, mais aussi elle aide à. Elle travaille en étroite collaboration avec le secteur privé et la société civile pour la formation donc dans le domaine de la sécurité et la sensibilisation. Donc là, on forme et on travaille sur la formation d'auditeurs certifiés en sécurité pour assurer un niveau de sécurité au niveau national. Donc il y a un travail en collaboration entre le régulateur, mais aussi en collaboration avec le secteur privé dans le domaine et aussi les sociétés civiles qui permettent de disséminer, de sensibiliser par rapport à la sécurité. Voilà, merci.
Chen Ken, please.
我对这个问题谈一点看法，我觉得刚才几位提到的。 网络安全，特别是关键的网络的基础设施的安全问题。作为网络安全，我觉得分两个层次，应该去建立它的处理的机制。首先，这些关键的基础设施啊，它一定会在它提前预防方面采取一些措施。那么，由于互联网是开放的，有些的网络安全事件它自己并不能处理，所以有些像国家的骨干网络，还有关键的基础设施，应该纳入政府的公共服务。 也就是像疾病一样，国家会建立疾病预防控制中心，是吧？一旦发生问题，应该有一个应急的反应的队伍帮着他解决这个问题。这主要是因为互联网的特点造成的，互联网是开放的，是无国界的。那么全球呢，也需要在这方面进行合作。对于终端的发生一些网络安全事件，我觉得应该建立市场的机制，由市场的机制来解决它。也就是说，要有两种机制，一种机制呢是靠企业的利益之。 利益机制为纽带，大家共同建立的一些对终端的这个网络安全事件的处理。另外，对于骨干网络关键基础设施，政府要纳入它的公共服务，来给予保障。当然了，刚才我也说了，还有一个呢，就是一旦发生了真正的网络安全犯罪的行为，应该有法律给予打击。否则的话，这个网络安全，即使你做了很多工作，最后一道防线没有的话，那么这个很多的工作呀。 可能就会就会显得苍白无力。我想的话呢，前面我说的政府做的这个工作是必要条件，但是不充分，应该加上它的充分条件，应该有相应的法律。一旦发现犯罪的话，应该给予打击。这是我的看法。谢谢。Thank
you, Christine. I would like to comment on the questions about international cooperation and especially the African countries that are starting to build their own instant response teams and their own infrastructures. I was talking this morning to some countries in Africa, and I was extending them to invitation that one of the best ways would be actually to look for other countries, to look for information how other countries manage to create the certs, how they interact with their own private sectors, their own public sectors. And one of the things that we are already doing, the Brazilian Internet Steering Committee is already doing, is to share and help some African countries with the top-level domain name registrations, and we would be happy to help some people to start their certs or to share the information and share the experience on how we got from the point that we had no cert and for the point that we have an operational team interacting with teams inside the country. So one of the it's really typical in Brazil. We started under the umbrella of the Brazilian Internet Steering Committee, that is a multi-stakeholder organization, so we can talk to all the sectors and we can actually receive feedback from the sectors, but each country needs to look for other countries and try to find out which would be the best model, and we would be happy to help people to understand how we work in Brazil and to help you to establish your teams also. So this is really the start of a cooperation, so cooperating and how to establish your capabilities and then further cooperate on how to actually deal with incidents and solve incidents. So start slowly, but start cooperating and sharing information at least on how to establish your own capabilities.
Well, I only have 1 minute before closing the debate. Zahid?
I promise to make it very short. Just responding to Russia's comment, I think, because I didn't understand, there was no question, but there was a comment, I think it was very good, which said that there is a need for international security, and basically with the ending was there should be international agreements, and I think that is a great suggestion from Russia. I think it's time that Russia, therefore, you know, joined in and signed the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrimes, because a lot of work has already been done, and so I completely agree with you.
Yeah, I have some 5-10 questions at my hands. I'm sorry I couldn't introduce this, and I couldn't even pick up from a remote audience. It's about time to close. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tabaras, Mr. Secretary, yes.
Yes, thank you, Yoshi. Our division of labor is such that the chairman can give his personal conclusions, that is his privilege, whereas I was tasked with trying or attempt to summarize the discussion. I would call it rather my reading of the discussion. Again, I think we had a very rich discussion, but also a very complicated and complex discussion, so I don't think my task is a very easy one, and I bear with your forgiveness if I will not give a very clear if I'm not able to give a very clear reading of this discussion. But again, we saw in the access discussion that access is normally seen as the single most important issue by many countries, of course by those in particular who don't have access, whereas countries where access is not an issue anymore, then security takes first place, as we heard from yourself, Mr. Moderator, and also a discussant who came in and mentioned the example of the United Kingdom. The issue certainly is a multi-dimensional issue, and again, multi-stakeholder involvement and multi-stakeholder cooperation seem to be essential ingredients if we are trying to find a solution. One of the problems, it seems, is that we don't actually have an agreement what we mean when we talk about security in the IGF context. We have, I think, a vague notion, and I think it is a fairly broad approach, but several speakers tried to give their own definition. One speaker referred to the control over the future and said that this was never 100% possible, as we don't know what the future will bring. Several elements were mentioned: national security, network security, the reliability of networks, also the issue of preventing before the event and finding solutions after the event. Also the resilient and secure networks were mentioned as a key in this debate. An important part of the discussion evolved around the legal dimension. I think here we had agreement that online and offline should not be treated differently. A crime is a crime. And I think our chairman mentioned at the beginning that 95% of the crimes committed online were covered by existing legislation. But several speakers pointed out that while legislation may exist, that the problem, the borderless nature of the internet, made cooperation among law enforcement extremely difficult, and law enforcement therefore was an issue that needs to be looked at. There are different approaches, and there's sort of between hard law and soft law. There was a strong call for harmonizing legislation and also for bringing in new legal instruments that apply in particular to the online world, and there the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime was mentioned. But there was also a warning against overregulation. While everybody agrees that there needs to be some kind of legal basis, many speakers pointed out that we should not over-regulate, and collaborative efforts of cooperation below the level of regulation could be sufficient.
Echoing this morning's discussion on openness, it was pointed out the role of the ISPs as a very crucial element. One speaker called for laws to protect them. I think the liability of the ISPs seems to be an issue that needs to be considered further. In terms of soft law solution, the representative of the OECD pointed to the OECD guidelines in these various fields. As regards the technical dimension, there I think one of the questions asked what we should look at the source of the problem. Raising awareness, human resource development, training people to handle the problem were part of the solutions, and also the need to think about security when designing and implementing, and to think about security also in the whole process. As the OECD representative pointed out, the culture of cyber security is relevant in this context. There was a discussion on what type of software was best suited, and there were clearly different views held. It was mentioned that transparency should be a key factor, and that security through obscurity would be is a flawed concept, and that open systems and designs that can be audited are more secure. However, other speakers held different views, and one speaker pointed out that from a developing country perspective, where designers were interested in developing new system, we should think of protecting intellectual property rights, and therefore proprietary solutions were equally valid, and that was echoed also by another speaker who said it was not clear whether non-proprietary or proprietary systems were better suited to tackle the problem. It was also pointed out that in the search for collaboration, international cooperation, there were also problems related to financial limitations and to the, I think it was pointed out, the training of law enforcement and also of judiciary. The connection, of course, was also made between security issues and human rights and privacy. And the point was made that developing privacy laws was actually a contribution to enhancing security. Now, with this haphazard summary, I give back to you, Mr. Moderator. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kumar. Now, Mr. Tavares. Your closing remarks, please.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Mr. Remain. I'll finish my intervention in Portuguese in order to be more clear with my ideas. Nós começamos esta apresentação dos panelistas com uma observação de que segurança é controle sobre o futuro. Controle sobre qual futuro nós estamos falando? Sobre o futuro da humanidade? Sobre o futuro da tecnologia? Sobre o futuro específico da internet? E quem faz a internet sem o ser humano? Nós precisamos de ter em vista a capacidade de relacionarmos países, culturas, hábitos e pessoas para que nós consigamos atingir esse futuro onde nós poderemos realmente nos harmonizar. Como era previsto, eu disse no início, nós podemos observar aqui diferentes opiniões. Falamos desde a criminalidade contra crianças, a cyberpornography, até o rapto, o sequestro de jornalistas, a assuntos políticos, assuntos mais sensíveis da área da humanidade. Nós precisamos muito é continuar essas discussões porque elas vão nos ajudar a cuidar, seja em termos de human rights ou de segurança, a cuidar do ser humano em sua evolução com esse novo meio de comunicação. O tema de segurança da internet comporta, além da estabilidade da própria rede e da integridade e confiabilidade dos seus conteúdos, especialmente a proteção a seus usuários por meio do combate à cibercriminalidade e da adequada tipificação dos delitos cibernéticos. Questão essencial para a construção de uma sociedade da informação centrada na pessoa, centrada no ser humano, o elemento mais importante desta rede. Ambas as dimensões devem reconhecer-se estão inteiramente relacionadas. Num contexto democrático, o combate à cibercriminalidade deve levar em consideração o necessário respeito pelos direitos individuais, em particular o direito à privacidade. Contando com o apoio da sociedade civil, da indústria, os governos têm um papel fundamental no estabelecimento da internet como espaço seguro de interação humana, dotando da necessária confiabilidade as comunicações, o comércio eletrónico e a prestação de serviços por meio da rede. Dada a natureza eminentemente transnacional dos delitos cibernéticos, a cooperação técnica, judiciária, policial e administrativa são instrumentos fundamentais. A harmonização das normativas internacionais sobre segurança cibernética deve ser considerada levando-se em conta as prioridades específicas de cada país e as realidades distintas dos mundos desenvolvidos e em desenvolvimento. No que se refere aos aspectos técnicos da segurança, o caráter evolutivo e dinâmico da internet faz necessária a criação de instrumentos ágeis e a constante atualização de métodos e intensa cooperação, assim como a adoção de medidas preventivas, sem que se perca o sentido de cada país, de cada cultura, de cada nação. A multiplicidade de aspectos apresentados pelos oradores, debatedores e pelo público demonstra que a segurança deve seguir recebendo atenção prioritária nos debates. Eu gostaria de concluir agradecendo a todos pela presença intensa num tema que nós poderíamos ficar dias, semanas, meses discutindo. Um tema que nos levará certamente a grandes discussões, mas que nós devemos manter sempre centrado sobre o ser humano. Muito obrigado a todos.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This concludes the session on security. I thank all the panelists, discussants, and all of you in the hall. Thank you very much.